If you would like to follow along in the church Bibles, there should be one on the shelf in front of you, and the reading is on page 628. So this is Psalm 139, a psalm of David. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the night light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. This is the word of the Lord.
Good. Well, do have that passage before you. And today in our series on the human journey, we come to the start of life. When does it begin? We'll be looking at the theological and the biological aspects, and to help us with the latter, we have Dr. Julie Maxwell, who's a member of St. Mary's and a paediatrician. Psalm 139 gives us, first of all, four lessons about God, from which you can see from the outline on the song sheet at the back, we learn three lessons about human nature. And what we learn in that particular psalm about God are these: that God is omniscient, that means he's all-seeing, all-knowing. The first six verses. God searches, God knows, God perceives, God discerns, and God is familiar with everything about us. And that divine knowledge extends to our thoughts, as well as our words, and as well as our deeds. The second thing about God is that he is omnipresent. He is everywhere, 7 to 12. His presence is not excluded from anywhere in his entire universe. And this section, 7 to 12, begins with a question. Where can I go from your spirit, verse 7? Maybe he once had got into his head the idea of fleeing from God. He'd probably wanted to hide from God many times because of his moral failure. But of course, such notions are impossible. For not only does God know everything, he's everywhere. And there are three possible escape routes that he momentarily considers in this psalm, which are then ruled out. The third feature about God is that he is omnipotent. He is all creative, all powerful, 13 to 18. God can search the man out, not only because he sees him, but because he created him. That the wonderful development of the embryo in the womb is down to him. We read both his inward being and his frame, 13 and 15, are God's. He saw it all developing. And even before he was born, all the days of his life were planned and recorded in God's book, 15 and 16. The thoughts of God, which he calls precious and vast, outnumber the grains of sand, 17 and 18. And then the fourth thing is God's judgment. He is all holy, 19 to 24. David is aware that he does not want to be on the wrong side of God, so he asks God to search him, to examine him, to lead him, to put him to the test so that he might be aware of anything offensive, or literally anything that would grieve God. His great desire is to expose and remove all moral and spiritual impediments to the way everlasting. And having kind of learnt those things about God through the psalm, we can then pick up things that we learn about human nature. And there are three principal lessons. The first is creation. You created, verse 13, my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Now, the Bible isn't an embryology textbook, but it affirms what is biologically clear, and that's that life begins at conception. That is the start of a process to maturity, from zygote to embryo, embryo to fetus, fetus to baby, baby to child, child to adolescent, adolescent to adult, adult to, well, whatever the next step is. Of course, the Psalms are poems or songs, and they use poetic and highly figurative language, like woven together in the depths of the earth, 15. Or, in fact, the word created here is also the word used of a potter fashioning a jar or a bowl. And so the imagery of the weaver and the potter are used to describe the creative powers of God, who oversees a process of creation that's neither haphazard nor automatic, but an example of God's great creativity. And we, if we are parents, are incredibly privileged to have a part to play in that. So creation. Then there's continuity. For the whole of our significance, God is related to us. So verse 1, you have searched me. The past. Verses 2 and 3, you know when I sit, the present. Verse 10, your hand will guide me, the future. Verse 13, you knit me together in my mother's womb, prenatal. So, antenatal and postnatal, in the womb and out of the womb, before birth and after birth. As embryo, fetus, child, adolescent, adult, geriatric, till your hair turns grey. I think that's Isaiah 43:10. It's become a comfort. Isaiah reminds us that there is a wonderful continuity. Throughout life, God is related to us. And there's what the Bible calls a special relationship between God and human beings, a covenant. It's the same God who created him, who now sustains him, knows him, and loves him, and who will forever hold him securely. This psalm is the most radically personal statement in the Old Testament of God's relationship to the individual believer. Now, I've made a mistake on the outline. It should read, the I-you, not the you-me relationship that it starts off with. The I-you relationship is throughout almost every line, The first person, I, me, my, occurs 46 times. But more important than that I-you relationship, which is David's relationship with God, is the you-me relationship, God's relationship with David. The second person, you or your, occurs 32 times, expressing the relationship of God knowing, surrounding, holding him, and then sticking to him, never leaving him, nor letting him go. As John Stott writes, what makes us a person is not that we know God, but that he knows us. Not that we love God, but that he has set his love on us. And establishing that principle, you can see how various other verses in the Bible that you might like to look up some other time indicate that the child in the womb is a person. So, Christians hold to the sanctity of human life because we're made in the image of God. We saw that last week, unlike any other animals. That human life begins at conception, that God has a relationship with us from that time. Now, Julie.
Okay. So, something a little bit different, a bit of a biology lesson this morning. Right, hopefully the projector's going to work. So, heard what the Bible has to say, and from my perspective, the biology very definitely fits in with that. So we're going to have a look at the miracle of the development of a baby, from fertilisation to birth in pictures, hopefully, if the projector behaves itself. This is the most biology lesson looking one. The rest are all just nice pictures. So at the point of fertilisation, the sperm enters the egg and the genetic material of the mother and father combine to make a new, completely unique genetic code. A new individual at this point has been created. From this moment, the development is a continuum from a single cell to a newborn baby to an adult, as Clive just said. The cells are rapidly dividing at this point, and the ball of cells moves into the uterus and implants into the uterine wall about a week after fertilisation. So it all happens very, very quickly. Projector? Maybe? Okay. So pregnancy as we know it is timed from the date of the last menstrual period, which is in fact 2 weeks before conception. So kind of from this point on, I'll be talking about weeks of pregnancy rather than after conception. But most people usually know or suspect that they might be pregnant when their first period doesn't arrive. And this is about 2 weeks after conception, at which point this is what the multiplying cells look like, not just a ball of cells, as you can see, even at this very early stage. So at this point, the cells have divided into two separate bits. You've got the placenta, and you've got the developing baby. And the cells are beginning to take on specific functions. You can already kind of see that things are all looking a bit different and that there are distinct bits. So you've got backbone forming, spinal column forming, and the nervous system, so some of the most important bits, are all forming. So very much more than just a ball of cells. And I think this one, these models, obviously you won't be able to see them very often. If you want to see them at the end, you can. But this just gives you an idea of about the size in real life at that stage. So just over a week later, on the 26th day after fertilisation, so about 5.5 weeks pregnant, the heart begins to beat. So very early on. The embryo at this stage is about the size of a raisin. Most of you can imagine that. And the growth is extremely rapid at this stage. The external features and the internal organs are all beginning to form, and the placenta is beginning to function. And at this point, the brain is divided into 5 distinct parts. And at this point as well, this is something that I was thinking about, on the 8th of September 2014, which is probably not a date that's stuck in most of your minds, there was an announcement. David Cameron said, "Many congratulations to the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. I'm delighted by the happy news that they're expecting a baby, Princess Charlotte." So at this point, because she was feeling so sick, Kate had to announce her pregnancy, and she was about 6 to 8 weeks pregnant at this point. So in that case, all around the world, in all the newspapers, there was a huge recognition that this was not just a ball of cells. This was a person. They were, you can look back at the news articles, and they're already talking about the fact that she's going to be fourth in line to the throne, etc., etc. So everyone realised that this was a person. 8 weeks pregnant. This is a picture. There's loads of brilliant pictures on the internet of a fetus removed from a non-viable ectopic pregnancy. So that's why it's kind of out. But you can see this fetus is about 12 millimetres long. It's constantly moving in the amniotic sac, but obviously the pregnant woman can't feel it yet. Brain waves can be measured. And another interesting fact, all 20 teeth buds are in place by this point. So you can see it's very much a baby. By 10 weeks, which I think is this one, so that's an actual size, which corresponds to that one. So by 10 weeks pregnant, so this is before most people have even told anybody that they're pregnant, every single organ is present. The embryonic period is now over, and 90% of the structures found in an adult human being are in this tiny baby, which is only about 4 centimetres long. Again, this is an actual photograph of a miscarried baby at 10 weeks. Picture kind of which is familiar to lots of people. So this is 12 weeks. So this is the point at which most people, when they're pregnant, have their, maybe not their first scan these days, but have a scan at 12 weeks. Often people have one earlier as well now. And they usually break the news to people that they're pregnant at this point. You can see, for those people who've had a scan, you can see the baby moving, you can see everything. It's about 5.5 centimetres long, weighs about 15 grams, which is about half of a bar of chocolate, maybe. The baby moves in response to touch, makes breathing-like movements. There's hair on the baby's head, and it has nails on the fingers and toes as well. So actually, from this point on, all this baby's got to do is a whole lot of growing. Is a picture of a baby called Noah, which again you can find on the internet if you Google it. He was miscarried at 12 weeks, and his parents took pictures of him. And as you can see, he's very, very tiny, but very definitely a human baby. And this is another really interesting one that you can find on the internet as well, which is a baby called Walter. And he was born at 19 weeks and 6 days. His mother went into, obviously, very premature labour. And you can find the story on the internet. And they decided to take pictures. There's even pictures of him being cuddled by his brother and sister, and by his mum and dad. Quite an emotional thing to look at. And his mother, Lexi, is quoted as saying, "He was perfect. He was fully formed and everything was there. I could see his heart beating in his tiny chest. I held him, our perfect tiny son." And this is often the stage as well when you're pregnant, when you start to feel the baby move. So it kind of makes it all a bit more real. So we kind of move on now to the next sort of milestone. That's about similar stage to that one. The next stage is about 24 weeks, 23, 24 weeks, which is the point at which baby is considered to be able to survive outside the womb. Obviously, at this point, picture goes off. At this point, the baby will need artificial ventilation, it will need nutrition, and there's a high chance of complications such as brain damage. But at this point, lots of babies do survive. Mostly, the baby would weigh about 500 to 600 grams, which is a pound for those of you pre-decimal. Although I once looked after a baby girl, who I remember very vividly, who only weighed 250 grams. She survived for 7 days and then didn't make it. But she was definitely there for 7 days, and she was lovely. At 24 weeks, which obviously is the point where babies can survive with intensive care, This is also the point at which abortion is legal up until. And in fact, until 1990, which isn't very long ago, it was legal up to 28 weeks. And in fact, it still remains legal up to term for babies with abnormalities. Kind of puts in perspective. So at 28 weeks, I love this picture, but babies born after 28 weeks may be capable of surviving with minimal medical attention. Sometimes they might just need feeding through a tube, but they may need very little else. They usually weigh at this point around a kilo or about 2 pounds. Quite a nice picture that I found with a baby being born by cesarean that's still in the amniotic sac. So this is a baby at term. So I've seen lots of births, maybe not as many as midwives have seen, but I've seen quite a few, and I'm always absolutely in awe of the miracle that is birth. What I think is amazing is how come, legally, the minute before birth, it's not a baby, and it doesn't have rights. The minute it's born, it suddenly has rights that it didn't have minutes earlier. Sounds a bit bonkers to me. The baby that's born can survive outside the womb, but of course it is still entirely dependent on adults to provide for its physical and emotional needs. Without this baby will die very quickly. He's no more capable of life without his mother than he was when he was a single cell. So the miracle of one cell to a baby in 9 months. So at what point in this process does this developing baby become a human? For me, it clearly occurs at that amazing moment when the genetic material fuses and a new, unique genetic code is created. We, however, live in a society where advances in science mean there are many ethical dilemmas around the beginning of life. Each one could be a whole talk in itself, so I'm not going to go into them in any detail, but a few quick thoughts. And if anybody wants to think any more about any, this is a book I would recommend. This is by John Wyatt, and it's got lots of ethical issues around life and death in it. So we need to think about some of these issues around the start of life in the light of biology and in the light of the of what the Bible says. The Christian Medical Fellowship the website also has lots of really interesting things on it. So the first one, some of the ethical issues. Contraception. Many of you might not think that contraception is a particularly ethical issue, and most forms of contraception prevent fertilisation. But there are forms, such as the coil and the morning after pill, which, incidentally, is now, quite recently, it's available over the counter without prescription to anyone pretty much who wants it. But the morning after pill may act to prevent implantation after fertilisation. So it prevents the fertilised embryo, life has already begun, from implanting in the uterus. So something to think about. IVF is another one. So the moment of fertilisation occurs in a test tube or a petri dish or whatever it is, a new life is created. But what about those embryos created that are then frozen? What about those that are never used, might be destroyed? What about those that are created that have abnormalities and therefore don't get chosen and get destroyed? Again, something to think about. Embryo experimentation. I don't pretend to understand much about embryo experimentation, but the latest kind of thing that's been in the news is about three-parent babies. Basically, there are lots of different ways that scientists are trying to experiment with altering genetics to try and get rid of some inherited conditions. But do these embryos being experimented on have rights? Are they human beings? Have we got the right to interfere with the genetics of a baby? Because our genetics is what makes us the unique individual that we are. And of course, abortion. So abortion has now been legal in this country since 1967, before I was born. And there have been approximately 8.2 million abortions since then. That's currently one abortion in the UK for every 4 live births, which puts that in perspective. So in 2013, there were 185,331 abortions in the UK. 1%, only 1% of those were because the child would be born with a disability, but that disability can include Down syndrome, limb abnormalities, or even just a cleft lip. And it creates contradictions. So in one part of the hospital, thinking back to the picture of the 24-week baby, one part of the hospital you might have a 24-week-old baby being aborted, and in a neonatal unit you might have a baby the same gestation receiving intensive medical treatment. Is the life of that baby really worth more than the life of the other one because that one's wanted by its parents and the other one isn't? Does whether we want a baby or not determine whether it has rights or not? Clearly not. And another issue, alcohol, smoking and drugs in pregnancy. There was a case recently in the news of a seven-year-old who'd been born with severe fetal alcohol syndrome. It went to court and they thought that it was a done deal, they would get compensation for this child, but they didn't. It was ruled that this child was not entitled to compensation because the Lord Justice said that an essential ingredient for a crime to be committed is the infliction of grievous bodily harm on a person. Grievous bodily harm on a fetus will not suffice. But that seven-year-old has to live with the consequences for that for the rest of their life. So there are lots of differing views on when life begins. Conception, implantation, when the heart starts beating, when you feel the baby move, when the baby's capable of life outside the womb, or birth. But I believe that the Bible and biology are both clear that a new, unique life is created at conception, and that human being is known and loved by God. That human being remains dependent on other people from conception right the way through the rest of its life.
Well, it is astonishing, isn't it, the speed with which we are created, and we're very complex, and very beautiful results come about at birth. So, now we're all familiar with principles expressed variously as the welfare of the child is of paramount importance, and that a child lacks the capacity to make the best decisions for itself. And so in our society, those older and wiser make decisions on its behalf, quote, in their best interests. As Julie said, in English law, a child is only regarded as a human being when it's born. But biologically and theologically, the start of life goes back much earlier than that. If we make decisions in their best interests for 2-year-olds and 11-year-olds, because they're still progressing on to adult maturity, should we not make decisions for zygotes, embryos, fetuses in their development? Now, if they could answer, what would they consider to be in their best interests? Well, of course, they can answer. What would you now say if, when you were in the womb, there was a discussion taking place about your continued existence or not? I would suggest that you'd say, I want to live. Look after me, protect me, don't terminate me, let me have life.